Accession number 28359, Reel 1.
Roy Gibbs, Reel 1. Roy, will you tell me when and where you were born?
28th of February 1925 in Stoke Newington, which was a suburb of London. In those days, a fairly leafy suburb. It's changed since, I believe.
Were you only child? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I was the only child. My father worked in the family business, which was a builders and decorators, which had been started by his father's father. Went back to 1866. So I was brought up in the environment, I suppose, of a building environment, almost.
And did you go to school in Stoke Newington?
Yes, Stoke Newington Central School, which in those days was a new concept, really, in schools. It was a combination of academics and commercial. I don't think they exist today, but in addition to all the academic subjects and one other language, which was French, we were taught typing, shorthand, bookkeeping. So it was a very broad education, really, with tendency to lean towards a commercial. I stayed there until the school evacuated in 1939, when I decided, since I was then 15 and a bit, that I wouldn't go with them.
In the build-up to the war, were you much? You were a young boy then. Were you aware of what was happening?
Oh yeah, one was aware that the war was inevitable, because we had debates at school on fascism and all that type of thing. We were all very active in those days as young people. I was a member of the Scouts and I used to go camping, and slowly all these sort of things became more and more restricted as the war got nearer and nearer. When the war actually broke out, they got all the scout troops together, those that hadn't evacuated, especially the chaps with bicycles, issued us with tin hats and gas masks, and we were asked to act as ARP messengers.
You were, how old were you then?
15.
And what did you find that particularly exciting or interesting as a 15-year-old?
Well, you're very young, it's all a big adventure, isn't it? Life's a big adventure, and that added to it, really. I don't think any of us realised the problems that were going to come later on, or the amount of bombing that was going to come. When it did, it worked. Like everybody else, it was a nasty shock.
What about your parents? What were, can you remember what their reaction was, or how they, what they were, their feelings were in the months leading up to the war?
Not really. I suppose one was so intrigued with this adventure that was going to happen to you, didn't really take much notice of how it was affecting other people. I do remember on the first day of the war when the sirens went, it turned out to be a false alarm, but I can remember people rushing into where we were situated in the town hall waiting to do our messenger work, and the women were crying, and quite a lot of women were crying. I think some were lived through the 1418 war, and therefore they had some memories of what was likely to happen again. My own parents, I think, were quite calm about the whole thing. We had a semi-basement to our house, which they turned into an air raid shelter if necessary. Never did have an Pucker air raid shelter. A huge old-fashioned oak table, which they used to sleep under when the bombing got bad.
And was this table in the basement?
It's a semi-basement, yes.
Yeah.
It's in a room my father used to use as an office.
And did you ever sleep down there with them?
In the early days, yes, when I wasn't on duty at the town hall, as we used to call it, as a messenger. Not so much in the early days, but when the bombing started, you know, they insisted I came under the table with them. At least my mother did.
Did your father see any service?
He was in the army in the 1418 war, in the infantry, I believe. In the last one, he served as a fire watcher, I think. That was about all. You know, it was, I think he was deemed rather necessary because running a building company, although a lot of his chaps had been called up, they were called in to help with the emergency work, getting people out of bomb sites and so on, and making houses safe after they've been bombed.
Before the war, were you going to follow him into the family business?
I didn't really have any thoughts about it. I think it probably was naturally assumed that I would. My education should have gone to the... Well, you had the opportunity to sit for the junior Oxford at this particular school. And I think I'd be more than once planned the plan that I would sit for that and go on if I could. But, of course, that all went by the board.
What is the junior Oxford?
In those days, it was sort of an examination which, if you passed early on, you had the opportunity to sit for Oxford itself for entry. It was a completely really a new concept in education. We were a mixed school, which again was unusual.
And this school was in?
It was in Stoke Newington, yes. It was actually called Stoke Newington Central School. There were, I think, about half a dozen spread around young London. They were experimental, really. So trying to combine commercial education with academic.
Do you have many memories of going into the centre of London itself in those days, any time in your childhood?
Vaguely, yes. I can't remember what it was. I seem to remember going to some big event. It must have been a Silver Jubilee or something of the previous king. I can't remember. I can just remember going there as a young boy, and I can remember an uncle of mine lifting me up onto one of the lions along the embankment by the obelisk there. When we were younger, we used to... I forget what it cost. I think it was sort of a Tuppenny all-day ticket or something on the trams. And we used to drive backwards and forwards under the tunnel that went down to the embankment on the trams, along the embankment, and spend the best part of the day doing that.
With your friends or with your parents?
With friends from school, yeah. And I was also a great cyclist. So I progressed from a ferry cycle up to a full-size bicycle. A bit of a loner. I used to go off cycling on my own. I did eventually, later on, join a cycling club. But I used to thoroughly enjoy cycling.
And your cycling trips, did you go, was it around London or did you go out of London? Did you go out of the suburbs?
Yeah, Stoke Newington was fairly close, not so urban as I say as it is now. It was fairly close to open country. I used to go up into Hertfordshire and cycle around the lanes. And big thing in those days was if you had a few coppers left over from your pocket money, you could have tea in a nice country sort of environment. All gone by the board now, of course.
So, how old were you when you joined the Scout movement?
Oh, very young. I can't remember the exact age. I joined the Cubs first and then progressed from the Cubs into the Scout movement. I think you used to transfer into the Scouts at the age of 10 or 11. I can't quite remember now. It's a long while ago.
And did this involve country trips, camping?
Yep, camping. We used to camp in the summer most weekends in Hatfield House, which is was a big country estate out just on Hatfield in Hertfordshire, and we were allowed to camp there on the estate. It's rather interesting, if I may digress momentarily. I found the training I received in the Scouts many years later when I was on a jungle course in Ceylon with my air crew. We were taken to the jungle and told to find our own way back. So jungle evasion if we were shot down. And eventually we got well and truly lost. My navigator wasn't navigating terribly well. We found that we'd hacked our way up a dirty great, well, I suppose it's really a very steep hill, but it seemed like a mountain, only to come to a complete stop with a large drop in front of our eyes. And the training I'd had in woodcraft suddenly came in, and I spotted a trail of where somebody had cut their way through nearby. I said, let's follow this, and we did, and actually guided us straight back to where we wanted to be. I think the training I got in the Scouts, it helped me in many ways later life.
So you're at this stage where war's broken out, and tell me how long or how before the outbreak of war, How did you get involved in this this cycle courier?
Well, it was about when war became imminent, I suppose it was about a few weeks before, and every scout district had what they called a district commissioner, who, I say, rallied round everybody, called in all the scouts who had bicycles and asked me if they would like to take part in assisting the ARP in event emergency by being messengers, and we all volunteered. And we were based in the town hall, which seems strange now, but and just delivering messages, you know, for...
So tell me, war breaks out, this first siren goes, and what then happened? Did you just take your bike, say goodbye to mum and dad, and cycle straight to the town hall?
At the time, we were actually there. We were already on standby. We used to sleep overnight, sort of. I think it's about, I can't remember, it's probably one night on, one night off. We used to sleep in the town hall at night. They made us a small dormitory where we could sleep. So we were on duty for 24 hours at a stretch.
So how many boys were there with their bikes?
Oh. It's a hard one. Long while ago. I would think probably about 20 or 30, might have been a few more. Because an awful lot had evacuated, of course, with their schools.
And your school was evacuated to, do you know where?
I don't know where they went. I remember going with all the young kids to, I think it was Dalston Railway Station, and helping with their baggage and that sort of thing, and seeing them on their way. But I just wasn't terribly interested, and my parents didn't want to force me to do it. And
at that time when the children were getting on the trains, can you remember any more detail about that?
Only crying mums and crying children. I think to lads of my age, this was going to be a big adventure. We knew none of the horrors of war. Most of us had been born post 1418. And it was just, life was going to become one big adventure.
Did your father ever talk about the 1418 war?
Not an awful lot. So I gathered that he was in a rifle regiment. He went to France, but I think rather more towards the back end of the war. I don't think he saw some of the terrible horrors there were in the early days.
And your mother, between, from your childhood onwards, did she work or was she a housewife?
She always a housewife. What happened, once war broke out, she ran the office for my father. It was again, you know, man power, or woman power became difficult to get, so she ran the office and answered the phone and all the other things. I think she also helped out on something else. I think one of the ARP things, I think she, not full time, but I think she helped out either, you know, getting teas and that type of thing for chaps who'd been on duty for a long while and had a rough time, you know.
So tell me about the first time you were ever called upon to, as a scout, as a cyclist, to deliver a message. What happened then?
Well, before the Blitz, no problem. You just cycled and delivered your message and came back. Once the Blitz started, then it became slightly more difficult, but you still went out in it, you know, and tried to get there. When the bombing was bad, you tried to get there as best you could. You know, we were given a free passageway by the police and so on, where perhaps we wouldn't have been allowed to go because we were on war work, as they termed it. It's hard to say now. I say it all seemed so much fun. It sounds horrible to say that, but it really did, Joey.
Tell me actually how it happened. Who organised the cyclists? Was it a scoutmaster?
It was a local district commissioner, and then the scoutmasters who hadn't been called to the service, the older ones, assisted him.
So who would give a message to the district commissioner?
Oh, this would come probably direct from the either the telephone exchange at the town hall, or everybody was doing emergency jobs. Perhaps the town clerk or someone wanted something urgently done. Anything that required delivering urgently and didn't justify, they had a small motor transport department as well, but obviously by then petrol was getting in short supply, it was rationed, and they relied more on us pedalling our bicycles and using the car transport.
So the district commissioner, did he get some sort of message written on paper? Or was it, what, or were there verbal messages?
Some were verbal, some were passed down on paper.
And then he would just go just, to, you'd just have a little rota of, were you on a rota or did he just...
Yeah, I say we did 24 hours on, 24 hours off. He would be on duty perhaps one 24 hours and one of the older scoutmasters would take over. So there's always somebody in charge of us, probably just as well. I don't think we were terribly well-behaved children in those days.
So you were given your message, and did you cycle with a tin helmet?
Yeah, tin helmet. They issued us all with tin helmets.
What was marked on the helmet? Did you have any markings?
No, just khaki.
A khaki helmet.
Yeah. I think they did eventually put an M on them for messenger, but I think it was some time later.
And then did you have to have your gas mask with you?
We were issued with, funnily enough, with the service masks, as against the... Well, we all had the little boxes everybody was issued with, but they gave us the khaki satchel things that the services had. I seem to remember that they weren't sort of terribly modern. I think they, again, were from the back end of the 1418 war.
So typically... You've got your message, you get on your bike.
Get on your bike and go, yeah.
and you go. And what, tell me, what sort of places were you delivering messages to?
To local ARP posts.
ARP posts.
Or to incidents, when the bombing started, to incidents more than anything, I would say. But really to the local ARP posts, any emergency that might have occurred.
And ARP stood for?
Air Raid Precaution Post.
And typically, where were these posts?
All over the place. I mean, the corners of streets, they had old brick-built so-called air raid shelters. They used to use part of those because they weren't deemed terribly safe for the civilian population anyway. So, they'd take over the school premises... all that, places that are empty because of the situation, they would create an air raid post, and they controlled that area. They had a chief air raid warden, and the air raid wardens, as I said, all mostly chaps who were over military age, or age for military service, I should say. Volunteers, a lot of them had been formed, I think, in the year before the war actually broke out, when the government knew that trouble was coming. They formed the RA Protection Service. They did a marvellous job. They helped get people out from incidents, people that were buried alive. In the early days, as you probably know from the history books, it was very sudden. One minute it was a phony war and nothing was happening, and suddenly all hell was let loose.
So you're carrying out your cycling duties from Stoke Newington Town Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on through the phony war, yeah? The quiet period before hostilities really...
Yeah, I mean, they suddenly formed air training corps units all over the country, and obviously we were immediately approached because we were organised. Would we care to join the local air training squadron, which we did? And like all the kids of that age, we all wanted to fly. So in the evenings, when we weren't on duty, we were studying at the Air Training Corps. Basic navigation, Morse. Again, lots of things that came in very handy when I was doing my service training, because by the time I got into the service, I could already read and send Morse. I could read and send signals with flags. We covered all the basics, which was the idea of having the Air Training Corps.
And it still exists today. So when you were in the Air Training Corps, presumably things then took on much more of a regimented, a military year? I mean, did you have...
Oh, yes, we issued with the bits of uniform at a time until we had... I think, they were 1418 war RAF uniforms, because they didn't have the collar and tie. You had the old high neck, which was from the 1418 war. But we issued those, and a full-time RAF flight sergeant was allocated to us from St John's Wood, which was RAF base. He used to have us on parade at weekends and march us up and down. Strangely enough, they took over my old school as a headquarters for the squadron. So we marched up and down the playground and generally taught military discipline. He had a voice like a foghorn.
You were 16 then, weren't you?
I must have been just coming up for 16 then. Must have been 16, yeah.
So were you considering, were you thinking at that time that when would you have been old enough to join the RAF or any of the services?
I think it was, with the Fleet Air Arm, it was 17 and a quarter. I think the RAF must have been the same.
So at that time, were you starting to think, well, if this war goes on for much longer, I'm going to be involved?
Oh, yeah, we were well aware of it, and strange enough, still looking forward to it.
Do you remember any incidents that were happening, that you were hearing about the war via the news, the wireless, anything like that? Do you remember Dunkirk?
Oh, yes, I mean, yeah, we were... One was aware of these things because everybody listened to the news continually. You could not know about it. I think every household had a map on the wall with pins in it, what was going on and where our blokes were and so on. And I think most of us at that age were just dying to get in and do our bit. And as I say, being young, still young lads, we were all desperate to become pilots, which... I believe it's supplied to the RAF a very good continual source of manpower, which was semi-trained, which meant they could cut down on a lot of the training. I actually changed to the Fleet Air Arm because my grandparents lived at Chandler's Ford in Hampshire, and I'd got this job at the Daily Express, and one was, apart from your ARP work, your ATC work, one still had to get backwards and forward to school, to work through the bomb streets and that. And I had a week's holiday, and my mother said, well, go and see Grandma and Grandfather down in Hampshire, which I did. And when I got on the train at Waterloo, it was full of Fleet Air Arm people going to Eastleigh, who filled me and regaled me with all these stories of life in the Fleet Air Arm. And I was so enamoured when I came back from the holiday, I saw a coupon in the Daily Express, of course, advertising the Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm Y scheme for aircrew. Sent off the coupon, got an almost immediate response, had to go to the Admiralty, something scared the life out of me because I was ushered into this room with all I could see was gold braid up to their elbows, who proceeded for about half an hour to fire questions at me on trigonometry and arithmetic and you generally and what you've done so far and rather, as we're discussing now, the story of your life. I put in for a pilot. So everybody wanted to be a pilot, unfortunately. And at the end of this, they said, well, I'm very sorry. We cannot offer you the job as a trainee as a pilot. We're full up. We're also full up with observers. But what we need is telegraphist air gunners, which is exactly the same job as you would do in the RAF as a wireless operator air gunner. Only we think you have to do a lot more because the Fleet Air Arm planes are so small, there are only two or three crew, you'll have to do basic navigation as well. So this sounded marvellous to me, so I put my name down very quickly. I was issued with a certificate to say that I was now a member of the Royal Naval Fleet Air Arm Reserve, and sent back to work. But within a month or two, along came the little Billy Doo saying, will you please report to HMS Royal Arthur Skegness?
Okay. Just going back, so you've got a lot of things on your plate here. You've got you're in the air training corps, and you're still running the messaging service from the town hall.
Yes, that did actually start to wind down a bit because I don't think they needed us quite so much. It was only in the early emergencies, and I think probably somebody was very reluctant to keep putting young people at risk.
Do you remember doing anything? Do you remember cycling at all where you were delivering messages and during an air raid? Do you remember seeing? Could you see aircraft or bombs or fires or?
Well, yeah, one could hear the dreaded German aircraft because of the distinct sound. You could hear the bombs coming down. I think one of the worst things was that I was actually out delivering a message, and it was in the road where my parents lived, which is Green Lanes in North London, and I could see down the end of the road flames coming up, and the police would not let me through. So no, you can't get through. All the telephone lines were down, you couldn't phone anybody. So I had to go back to the town hall and sort of get away the next morning. I had to stay on duty because they needed someone there anyway. I managed to get home and find that my parents were okay, but the sort of all along beyond them, everything was flattened. And I don't think my mother ever forgave me. She couldn't quite understand that I couldn't get through, and she thought I was overdoing the duty bit, staying on duty all night. But yeah, she's slightly irrational about it.
Yeah, understandably.
Yeah.
So tell me about your. How did this job with the Daily Express, the newspaper, how did that come about?
Well, one of the scoutmasters said, you should be working. This isn't enough to keep you occupied. How would you like a job at the Daily Express? Once again, my eyes lit up. Fantastic, yeah. So he took me along and he introduced me to a chap called Jerry Sheff. I think he was then the entertainments correspondent for the Sunday Express, who interviewed me, and he said, yes, there was a job going. I'd have to start at the bottom, 15 shillings a week, no expenses. and I could start the following Monday, which I did. The job was, of course, that in those days, it was called a cub reporter, but it was you were the dog's body. You fetch their cigarettes, you fetch their tea. I did find a little angle there, which is interesting. The printers used to send out for big mugs of tea on a galley.
On a
printing galley. You had the big mugs. You had a big printing galley, the half a dozen of these big mugs that leads to the dairy over the road. And I found that if you could do this job for them, you've got three halfpence of tea in the mug. The odd halfpenny was yours. It doesn't sound a lot, but fourpence when you're earning 15 bob a week. So I got myself into the job of collecting the compositor's tea as well. Fortunately, unfortunately for the poor chaps who were being called up, people were being called up rapidly. The promotion ladder was obviously very open, and I very quickly been allowed to do all sorts of more responsible stories and even getting out to cover certain things. So that's a very good training, and I was attached to a chap called Dowdo Gallagher, which would mean probably nothing to most people. He was the leading, what they called, Western Front correspondent at the time. Had a great reputation, actually. And being attached to him, again, I didn't manage to get out to France with him, but I learned an awful lot about journalism.
Roy Gibbs, Reel 2. Roy...